What is going on, everybody? John Middlecoff. That is me. Three and Out Podcast. That is this podcast. Live and in charge right after this AFC South barn burner. Well, not really. Just the Jaguars beat the Titans 27. The Titans looked awful. We're going to dive right into Jalen Ramsey here in a second. Might even touch a little bit on Marcus Mariota. I mean, is he just not that good? Going to talk about the Cowboys and Dak, and I think it's played out perfectly for all parties. Eli Manning benched, you know, Twitter freaked, and you know, all of his former teammates are saying he's getting the short end of the stick. Like, come on, guys. They drafted a quarterback sixth overall. Why is anyone shocked? And is Eli a Hall of Famer? I'll give my take on it, because I've actually really gone back and forth over this just over the last couple of years, where it's pretty clear that we're at the end of the Eli run, and is he worthy of wearing a gold jacket? As always, I'll go through every game. You know, I spend about a minute, you know, just a couple things that stand out to me about the games. There are a couple. We got the Dolphins and the Jets. This might be an NFL record, week three, are combined a 55-point underdog. I don't even know how that's statistically or physically possible, but if you combine them, one's the Jets are at the Patriots and the Dolphins are at the Cowboys, combined 55-point underdog. As I last checked, I mean, that number could be like 60 by the time you listen to this. 55 points, two teams. That is insane. Like the Raiders at Minnesota, 9 points is a pretty big line for just two NFL teams in week three. 55 points. And then the Middlecoff mailbag, like always, at John Middlecoff is my Instagram handle. You slide up in those DMs and I answer them at the end of the podcast. But let's start with this. Jalen Ramsey, you know, the best corner in football, requested a trade after Sunday's game. And after anything like a football game, football probably of all the sports, because you spend all week getting ready for a game, is so emotional, win or lose. That's why any player or coach will tell you there is nothing like the feeling just in the locker room after a win, just everything you put in. Just like there is nothing worse than after a loss. It's just devastating. And having been in an NFL building, those first couple days on Monday and Tuesday after a loss are the worst. There's no way around it. I will never miss that feeling of coming into the office at 6 or 7 in the morning on a Monday morning after a bad loss. That's just, I don't even know what could relate to it. You know, my other podcast, we get paid quarterly deals with ad agencies and companies. And if it goes up, if it goes down, you guys can relate if you have a good Q1 or a bad Q3. I mean, unless it costs you like your job or your livelihood, it's not like that devastating, you know. But that feeling of a devastating loss is just so real and so fresh. It's hard to put into words. And crazy shit happens. You know, the hard part about comparing football to real life is you can't really MF someone in your office and really be normal after it, right? I mean, seriously, scream at someone, F you, and just operate like it's normal from there on out. It is never the same. But in football and in just pro sports in general, you're constantly kind of doing that. You're doing that with the referees. You're doing that with sometimes your own teammates, sometimes your own coach. Can you imagine the coach is kind of equivalent of a boss for a player? Can you imagine screaming that at your boss? I mean, in most lines of work, and whatever was screamed at between Jalen Ramsey and Doug Marrone, that wouldn't really fly, and there would be no coming back from it. But in sports, people come back from it all the time. And I get he asked for a trade, and I saw the quotes that Tom Coughlin said something to him. I got news for you. You take a deep breath, you play a game 4 days later, you win. I think you can rebound from this. I don't truly know the feelings inside the Jaguars locker room, what they think about Jalen Ramsey, besides obviously they know he's a good player. But if he's just a complete pain in the ass, I mean, clearly he's kind of tough to deal with. He's an emotional guy, somewhat of a front runner. When things are going well, he's great. When things are going bad, he's tough to deal with. But I know this. He is an elite player. He is the best player on their team. And I also know this. Their division's wide open. There's a decent chance that 9-7 wins that division. Are the Titans winning 9 games? Are the Texans winning 9 games? Are the Colts winning 9 games? I don't know. You know, I think maybe one of those three teams might win 9 games. I watched the Jaguars with Gardner Minshew. I think they could win 9 games. Their defense is big time. I mean, they got multiple corners. They got linebackers that can fly around. They got an incredible defensive line. They got this quarterback that's kind of infused some life. And they have an elite player in Jalen Ramsey. So if you do truly hate him and you get a haul, I get trading him if someone gives you two first-round picks. But if the Kansas City Chiefs went, hey, Shad Khan and Doug Marrone and David Caldwell, we'll give you two first-round picks. Couldn't you take a step back and go, well, we drafted Jalen Ramsey fifth overall. He's the best corner in the league. And the Kansas City Chiefs, there's a chance, you know, best case scenario, they win the Super Bowl the next 2 years with Jalen Ramsey. So both they give us two picks at 32. Let's say worst case scenario, they get knocked out in each of the first round. Well, they're going to win the division and have a one or two seed. So that pick would be like 25 or 26. So let's say we get picked 25 2 years in a row. Is that cool for Jalen Ramsey? So yeah, your two first round picks sound great in theory. Like remember when it was so cool and the Raiders got two first round picks? And then it turns out it's pick 24 and 26, more than likely, for Khalil Mack. Like, that's not that cool. So I understand not paying him if you're not comfortable with paying him. I get that. You know, that's, I'll never understood that with the Raiders. You pay Khalil Mack whatever he's worth unless you don't have the cash, which is pretty clear. It's starting to be evident that Mark Davis didn't have the cash. Shad Khan, does he have $75 million in his bank account right now to pay him? I don't know. I think he's got a little more cash than like the Raiders, that's for sure. But I get the apprehension to paying a guy that you are uncomfortable with. Here's the other thing. There are differences between character guys. Like we see a lot, Ray Rice, right? Tyreek Hill, some of these situations that are like potential criminal activities. Greg Hardy, what's going on with Antonio Brown? And then you see the guys like get DUIs. Like there are stuff with the law that makes you very uncomfortable and would make any human uncomfortable. Then there are character guys that, you know, just egomaniacs that are hard to deal with in the locker room. That becomes troublesome, right? I think DeSean Jackson, when I was in Philly, was kind of one of those guys. It was like, you know, he's never been in trouble that the public knows about. But no, in all seriousness. But he's just, you know, moody and not the best teammate time and time. And, you know, when he's a younger player, there are guys like that all over the league. I guess not all over the league because there are not that many good players. But there are several good players that are a pain. And I think at the end of the day, if you're the Jaguars, and here's what else that makes it unique. He's not Le'Veon Bell, or he's not Melvin Gordon. He's not an idiot. He realizes, you know what? I know Twitter tells me that all players are oppressed, but I actually make $7.5 million. So yeah, I'm going to play, and I got pride, so I'm going to play my ass off. So he's not going to miss any games. So even if he's mad at you, he's still going to show up and he's going to play hard. He's the best player on your team. I just keep him. Unless he told me tomorrow, like, I'm not playing any more games for you. Then maybe I'd have to pivot. But if he tells me that I'm willing to keep playing and play hard, I just want to get paid, which I think ultimately is the case, I just keep him. I don't know why you trade him. Because again, two first-round picks, are like even if Seattle's like, hey, we'll give you two ones, that might be pick 23 and 28. Now, I get draft capital is great, but I'm always a believer, especially in baseball, I'd always trade prospects for elite players. Like, oh, we want draft picks. Well, what are the draft picks? Because, oh, I traded Amari Cooper and Khalil Mack, and you got a hard-hitting safety and a running back. Oh, we traded Odell Beckham for a first-rounder. You got a nose tackle. You know, it's one thing. Like, we traded so-and-so player for a first-rounder, and we got J.J. Watt. I'd be like, okay, that worked out. We traded this guy for a first-rounder. We got Julio Jones. Okay, gotcha. Most times it's like, we traded this guy, and we got Solomon Thomas. You're like, oh my God, why did I do that, right? So I think if all things are just can calm down a little bit, and even if teams are offering you two first-round picks, how are you replacing this guy? He's the best player in your team, and you can make the playoffs. It's clear this division's kind of wide open. The AFC is wide open. Gardner Minshew, I like him. Mustache is sweet. I'm telling you, I would just let it play out. Maybe I'm old school, but I still enjoy just watching players and having you just pass the eye test. Like, yeah, I'm always like this. I'm a lifetime radio guy, big sports talk radio guy, and then I had the opportunity to work in radio. And sometimes, like, a show would be highly rated, and I'd listen. I'd be like, this show sucks. And sometimes it would be the opposite. And I remember just thinking how random numbers were. Like when I had a radio show, we hit number one 1 month, and the next month it could be like 15th, because it was all based on this kind of random metric system with these meters in the market. It's why radio's kind of dying, because they can't quantify anything. And I think for the most part, you know, if you have high sales as a restaurant, you probably have pretty good food. You know, like when I drive by Chick-fil-A or In-N-Out, there's a reason the drive-thrus are consistently packed, because the food's good. And every time I go there, I'm happy, right? And I can watch in pro sports, basketball and football. In baseball, you're not allowed to, because the analytical guys will shame you. So we can't have a conversation with just, oh, this guy's good, oh, this guy sucks, because they'll always come at you with war, FIP, and schmip, and nip. And it's why the casual guy doesn't follow baseball anymore. It's not fun to do. But in basketball, and definitely football, we can just talk about a guy. I have no clue what Marcus Mariota's box score is. And I've met him a couple times. I like the guy. He's clearly a high-character guy. He was a Pac-12 guy. I'm naturally going to root for the guys coming from the conference out west. But he's just not very good. And it's not all his fault. It's not like he's playing with Terrell Owens and Randy Moss. His offensive line's terrible right now. He's got a defensive-minded head coach. They're a physical football team, but he's just not good enough. I once, back in the day, compared him to, like, I thought he had the chance to be a better Alex Smith. And Titans Twitter, sneaky, pretty angry and pretty aggressive, and they attacked me. And it turns out that he'd die to be a better version of Alex Smith right now. He's just not a very good player. He's not a great thrower of the football. He's not a very accurate thrower of the football. And his arm strength's just kind of average. And then in terms of pocket presence, you'd say it's average at best. Doesn't have a great feel for timing. And I think that sometimes that's when, you know, you play in a college offense that you're used to having guys wide open instead of using the natural feel of throwing guys open, which is something that, you know, back in the day, quarterbacks would get to kind of develop in college. Now that's not the case, because these spread kind of air raid offenses get guys wide open. That's what kind of makes Gardner Minshew, you know, kind of special. It's like he's kind of got a natural feel for the position. But then you look at kind of how he came up, JC balls, different colleges, you're like, okay, well, he's seen a lot over his career. But at the end of the day, Marcus Mariota looks like he's destined to be a backup, and almost destined to, like, are we sure he's going to be the full-time starter this season? Because he's not going to get a long-term contract in Tennessee. I would imagine Ryan Tannehill becomes the starter in the next month or two, especially if the Titans, you know, fall behind or in last place. But sometimes stuff can just pass the eye test. If you drive by an In-N-Out, there's a reason 75 cars are always in line. Every freaking one you drive by in California. Go to a Chick-fil-A after about 4:30. I only have one near me. But if you go by after about 4:30 to about 9 o'clock, I would say the average amount of cars in line are, I don't know, about 30. So you don't even need to eat it to go, God, there's something there. And then you eat it and you realize, God, this thing's pretty good. But all I know is this. You can make excuses for the guy, whatever. You just turn on the tape. You turn on the television, you turn on a Mariota game, and you go, something is off. You know, and sometimes his numbers aren't as bad as he actually played, because I pulled up his box score while I was talking, and if you just looked at his box score, now he wasn't very accurate, 23 or 40, but he threw for 300 yards. Now he was also sacked 9 times, and that's one thing I want to preface. I'm not blaming this all on Marcus. It is not all of his fault, and I think my comparison, like Alex Smith, Alex was never an eye test guy, ever. Even when he was playing well in Kansas City, it was hard for the casual fan to kind of see it, because he didn't do anything that made you go, "That could I do that if I was playing flag football or pickup football? If I was at recess when I was 15? And the reality is you couldn't, but his arm strength was average. He didn't move that fast. Like, at least Mariota kind of moves. But it's just hard to quantify what Alex brought to the table. The problem for Mariota, it's hard to quantify it, because the box score never looks that great and the eye test doesn't look that good. And now Tennessee is at the point where they don't have a quarterback, so they're going to have to find one. I'm not exactly sure what they do. I mean, this year they don't really have any options. But at the end of the day, do you know what it turns out? Mariota's just not very good. And we've gone back and forth with Jameis and Mariota, and I'm not the biggest Jameis guy, but I'm not going to completely write him off because he's got Arians. And the difference of Jameis and Mariota is Jameis got weapons. Godwin's a baller. Obviously, Evans is a star. O.J. Howard and Brake can play. They got dudes to throw to. And they got an offensive head coach. So I don't really, to put a bow tie on this, I don't really know how it ends. But I'm pretty certain, I'm actually positive. Marcus Mariota is not the long-term answer for the Titans. I just think we all know that now. And it's just, is he going to finish the season as the starter? I think that's now the question moving forward. I'm sure many people listening to this are married men, and maybe we have some women that are listening, but I think the majority of this demo that consumes the Three and Out podcast are men. And I think most guys will say that are married, I knew pretty early on in my relationship that I was going to marry the woman. Some people will say I knew the first night I met her, I knew the first time we went on a date, whatever. It usually, I think it's fair to say, happens relatively quickly. You know you really like the person and want to be with them. Now, not everyone knows they want to spend the rest of their life with someone after date one, but you got a pretty good idea, like this could get pretty serious pretty fast. And I think in somewhat parallels, quarterbacks are the same way. And I think when you look around the league, when you draft a guy really high, just on the most simple premise of if I draft a guy in the top 15 picks, or hell, let's just say the first round, I want to get married to that guy. Now, literally, you know, sign him to a long-term contract when I say the word marriage to a player, right? If I draft a player in the first round, especially in like the top 10 picks, I want that guy to be my quarterback for the next decade. Mahomes, Watson, I mean, the Bears wanted to be with Trubisky. He's not the guy. Josh Allen, Baker Mayfield, Sam Darnold. Obviously, over the history of the league, that happens, right? It's pretty black and white. But once you get past like the third or fourth round, I'd say Russell Wilson's somewhat of an outlier. And remember him, the first time he got his big contract, there were still some questions like, is this guy really the guy? Or is it the team? Because anytime you draft a guy later in the draft, fourth, fifth, sixth rounder, and that guy becomes your starter, and really the sixth rounder, that Brady's an outlier. But like in the middle rounds, Russell Wilson, you're seeing it with Dak now. Mason Rudolph is going to get his chance to start with the Pittsburgh Steelers. You passed on that player, who is by far the most important player on your team, several times. Like when Rodgers took over for Favre, it was a double whammy. One, they were getting tired of Favre. Two, Favre was getting older. Three, they had drafted Rodgers in the first round, meaning they had really, really liked the player. Now, did they know when they drafted him in the first round he was going to turn into what he became? Of course not. But they clearly really liked him in the draft. And then he fell to them, I think he picked 24. They draft him. He sat for a while, but clearly when he was sitting, they're like, damn, we got something here. On a higher level, because it happened a lot faster, and Alex Smith is not Brett Favre, it happened at warp speed with Mahomes. Where when you talk to people in Kansas City, they're watching him in practice, they're like, holy hell, we got something here. Now, you never know you got Rodgers, you got Mahomes, till they actually play, but I think you can get a pretty good idea in practice, like, damn, this guy could be pretty good. And that's why I think the Cowboys, ultimately, because I get a lot of people tweeting at me, and DMing me, Middlecoff Mailbag, at John Middlecoff Instagram, that have the Cowboys waited too long? Well, they drafted the guy in the fourth round for a reason. They never thought in a million years, like the rest of the league, this guy would be what he has kind of become, a franchise quarterback. So when you are in that situation, like sometimes if you don't know right away with the girl, but you do like him, it's healthy to date. Some people date, you know, 2 years before they get married. Some people date 5 years. There is no direct path to how you have to end up with someone. Same thing with a player, especially when you draft a guy in the middle of the rounds. So I completely understand, despite everything Jerry said, of them just kind of waiting. Let's make him prove how good he is. Because we weren't the only ones. The entire league, in a quarterback-starved league, passed on this guy round after round after round. And then through the first couple years, a little bit like Russell Wilson, you're like, well, our team is so good. Our defense is so awesome. How good is he? And there were still questions. Like, it was pretty clear, even though Wentz gets hurt a lot, like, yeah, that's what it looks like. And I'll go to the mat for Wentz so far through two games. In the second half, that guy has flipped a switch where you go, and I've said this over and over, the only guy that has the ceiling Mahomes has is that guy when he's on, because he just looks like a different level. I've compared him to Shaq. He just looks different. You know, he's just different. You know, same with Mahomes. But Mahomes, we've seen somewhat before because he he's like a more accurate, younger Favre. And Favre won 3 straight MVP, so Mahomes still has a ways to go. But you catch my drift here. Like, I'd actually think and give the Cowboys a lot of credit, because it's going to cost a lot of money no matter what. The moment Jared Goff signed for $110 million, and let's face it, you know, Les Snead was there, Kevin Demoff, the president, was there, Kroenke owned the team, they drafted the guy number one overall. So the moment they drafted him number one overall, in the back of their mind, they were hoping to sign him not just to $110 million, they want to sign him to multiple contracts. Same thing with Carson Wentz. That's easy. The Browns, the Jets, the Bills, now the Ravens with Lamar, they want the Mahomes. They want to sign all these guys. The Bears are praying to God that Mitch turns it around, because they use the number two overall pick on him. With the Cowboys, you're like, we took a guy in the fourth round. He's pretty good, but can we replace him? And they're starting to learn, no, we can't. This Dak character with Kellen Moore and Amari Cooper and Zeke, and now Jason Witten shaved his head and he's back from the booth. He's really freaking good. Because so far, Dak, 7 touchdowns, just looks awesome. Throwing, you know, it feels like 99% completion percentage. I get last week they're playing the Washington Redskins, but you go on the road and you throw 26 to 30. Like, you just watch Dak play, and I've watched both their games back on, you know, Monday after the week, because I don't get Cowboys games live where I live. And plus, I always go with one of my local teams on one TV, and then the other TV I got Red Zone on. But now that Kellen Moore's the offensive coordinator, the Cowboys are one of my first watches Monday morning. I thoroughly enjoy them. And it's pretty clear Dak looks unreal. Dak looks like a $30-plus million quarterback. And if he does it a couple more games, Jerry and Steven, despite everything they've said, we wanted to pay him, we have no trouble paying him, they were unsure if they wanted to get married to Dak. And there's nothing, and I don't blame him, because I was unsure too. But with every pass that he throws, and the eye, you just turn on the freaking game. It's pretty clear that he's a dude, and he's a big-time dude. And sometimes it just takes a little longer to prove that. It did for Russell Wilson, and he's become a Hall of Famer. You know, Cam Newton, Andrew Luck, when those guys go one, those teams, no matter what, unless those guys sucked, were going to sign to multiple contracts. Now, both those guys were really good, and it was easy to sign to a second contract. But when you draft a guy in the middle rounds at quarterback, given how much money you have to pay him, sometimes you need to see a little more, and that's healthy. And I don't blame the Cowboys one bit for just letting it play out a little bit. And I give Dak some credit. Like, show him what you're worth. And if you play well, you're only going to be worth more. I actually think this, for all the BS and the fluff that happens now with the Melvin Gordons and Zeke holding out and Le'Veon Bell skipping a year, I give Dak a lot of credit for being mature, acting like a pro, kicking ass and taking names, dominating, and, I mean, throwing his hat into the MVP mix. Getting with Kellen Moore, someone clearly he's comfortable with because he's played with him, now he's coached him, now he's the offensive coordinator. They're on the same page, and they're hell to deal with right now. I mean, they look, beside the Chiefs, to me, just fun to watch, they're the most fun offense. Patriots would be right there too, but the teams they play suck. I guess they played the Steelers in the first game, but once you're playing the Dolphins and the Jets, I can't even judge you. But to me, the Cowboys are easily a top 2 or 3 offense in the league just to watch. And the way it's played out, like I think it's played out perfectly for the Cowboys too, because people are like, I can't believe you're paying. Yeah, I don't like paying Matt Stafford $100 million. I don't even love paying Matt Ryan $100 million. Aaron Rodgers, you got no choice. Russell Wilson, you got no choice. Carson Wentz, Jared Goff, like when you draft a guy that high and they're good, that's what you're going to pay him. With Dak, I completely understand all sides. And I think it's working out perfectly for everyone. For Jerry and Steven, they got their franchise quarterback. For Jason Garrett and Kellen Moore, he's going to get Jason Garrett a contract extension. It's going to put Kellen Moore on the freaking map. For Dak Prescott, he's balling. He's getting a lot of praise. He's going to get a lot of money. Again, win, 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 win. Now, it's taken them 4 years to figure this out, but not everyone is love at first sight. Not going to spend too much time on Eli because, listen, Eli's been shot for years. You know, he's 37, 38 years old. He's a shell of himself. He can't move in a league where you need the quarterback to be more mobile than ever because there are more elite pass rushers than ever. So he's a statue. He's just a archaic version of what you need to be in this league. But I think, and I knew it was coming, that Twitter would overreact every different way, and social media in general. One, when Eli was originally benched. the reaction, especially from his former teammates, guys like Sean O'Hare, a lot of former players in the league, their reaction is very predictable. Very, very predictable. Eli, this is, the defense stinks, the wide receivers stink. This is not fair to Eli. You can't do Eli like that. It's like, hey guys, I don't know if you realize, but every penny you ever made as a player comes from the fans and comes from fan interest. And the moment you get apathy set in as a team, it's when your team starts to lose money. And that's when, if it happens to a lot of teams, that's where the league could be in trouble. And ask everyone, the Niners and UCLA currently, they employ Chip Kelly. Chip Kelly brings apathy immediately with him. Costs a lot of people a lot of money. You can't have that. And when your quarterback, the entire fans are, have never been smarter. Doesn't mean they're always right, but it's pretty clear. Like, what am I watching the Giants game for? For Saquon, for his 10 rushes a game? What am I doing this for? Because the most valuable thing the NFL has right now, why it's running circles around leagues like the NBA and Major League Baseball, is the power it has to grab your attention. 3 hours every week. Actually, way more than that. I mean, you're going to watch your team every week, and you're also going to consume a lot of other teams. You're not going to miss the Sunday night game. You're not going to miss the Monday night game. I'm recording this before the Thursday night game. If you're a football fan, you're going to watch that. They hold your attention through interest, through fun, through you just never really know what's going to happen for the most part. And when teams become really boring and you have bad quarterback play, even guys like me that do this for a living change the channel. You couldn't pay me to watch Eli Manning right now. The Giants owed this to their fans. And as Don Draper once said, why is Eli going to act like a good guy? That's why you get paid. That's what the money is for. And plus, Eli is not your classic like 22-year-old progressive, just into himself. Like, he was raised the right way. He gets it. Like, he's going to act like a pro. He is a pro. He's a high-level guy. So was his brother. They don't just tap out when a little adversity hits. This isn't just Twitter in 2019. Oh, it's over, just leave. This isn't the NBA. Like, guys, just handle like a man. He'll be a good teammate, and he'll back him up. And again, he's paid $17 million to do that. So I'm not feeling bad for Eli at all. And I saw Colin said he's the highest paid player in NFL history. I Googled it today. His career earnings after this year in the, I mean, this is pretty nuts, are $252 million. He's made $252 million, which I think a lot of it he's earned. Like, I'm not disputing that he's stealing it. Again, he's not Chip Kelly. He's not stealing from organizations and universities. He's earned that money. Now, the last couple years, we could argue. This is the Giants' problem. They got a little too emotional, and I saw this with the San Francisco Giants, who held on to players that they shouldn't have because they won them World Series. And the problem when you win big, unless you're Bill Walsh, unless you're Bill Belichick, you can't separate the two. So usually that's when you make mistakes in contracts or when you struggle to separate from an individual player. But I think ultimately they did the right thing. And here's where, like, the Giants told you what they thought about Eli. They drafted a quarterback 6th overall in April. Like, people get too caught up in words. This guy said this about this guy. This coach said this about this player. Who cares? Just look at who they draft. Look at who they play. Look at whenever a business CEO says something, just look at where they're allocating their money. Stop wasting your time worrying about what people say. Nothing means less in this, and I'm someone that talks for a living. But if you don't know how I live, you could just say I'm just full of hollow words. Like, if I ran a company or ran a business and I say one thing and I do another, I'm a fraud. And a lot of teams do that. They say one thing and they do another. Like, the Giants drafted Daniel Jones 6th overall. He was going to play. This isn't 1987. Quarterbacks don't sit for years anymore. That's not the way it works. When you draft a guy 6th overall and your quarterback's not getting it done, he's done. The other guy's going to play. Whether he's Eli Manning, Joe Namath, or me. It doesn't matter. And here's the other thing. The Eli Manning Hall of Fame debate. I've thought about this for a while. Because, like most people, I think you could easily make the argument he's not worthy of the Hall of Fame. Because he has been a very, very inconsistent quarterback. Had multiple year, 25-pick year, a 27-pick year. Has clearly been atrocious the last couple years. Missed the playoffs several times in his career. But I start thinking about, because the other night I was bored flipping around the channels at like 9 o'clock at night, and I flipped on NBA TV, and it was the Jazz against the Bulls, 98 finals. And sometimes I think to myself, what is sports all about? Well, the number one thing pro sports are about are money, because they're a business. And the number two part about why the players play the sports is to win. Like, that's the most important thing. And I think that's been lost in the culture of today with social media. Like, it's so cool to get a bunch of stats. And it's harder in the NFL, I'd say, than the other two sports to produce elite stats and not be a winning player. Now, it can happen. You know, like Jalen Ramsey can play on a bad team and he can be an elite player. But if you're a wide receiver, if you're a quarterback, and you're putting up really good stats, for the most part, you're probably going to win a lot. And Eli's been a little hit or miss with that. But his two highs of winning two championships, and I think the NBA is a better parallel for this. We have been just smothered with people telling us that James Harden's a better player than Michael Jordan, that Chris Paul is the point god, and neither of them can win a damn thing if their life depends on it. Every year they try their hardest, and they can never even get close to getting over the top. They're just full of hollow. Russell Westbrook's another good example. Just a ton of stats. They'll be Hall of Famers, and most people that are 18 years old think they're the greatest players ever. And when it comes nut cutting time, the Warriors or LeBron just kick their ass. Like, it's just rinse, wash, repeat. And at the end of the day, Eli Manning twice saw Belichick and Brady with all the chips on the line and beat them. Beat them twice. Not just once, where you can go, you know, a little fluky, Trent Dilfer, Brad John. Beat them twice with 50 million people watching. The best coach and the best quarterback ever, he beat them. And to get there, in 2007, he went on the road in that frigid day when Tom Coughlin's face froze off and won a game at Lambeau in like negative 40. But his most impressive stretch ever was 2011. And then, don't forget, in the Super Bowl was technically in 2008, beat what I think many consider the greatest team of all time, 18-0. He won. He was holding the Lombardi at the end of that game. Eli Manning, not Tom Brady and Belichick when they were 18-0. They finished 18-1. Like, that happened. And then in 2011, and it was technically 2012, January, he went through Aaron Rodgers, who had just won the MVP, and a Packer team that I'm pretty sure was 15-1, beat him in Lambeau. Then in the NFC Championship game, he faced a team which, in my lifetime, is probably a top five or six defense I've ever seen. Definitely from a physicality standpoint. In Harbaugh's first year with the Niners, Alden Smith, Justin Smith, Willis, Bowman, Golson, Whitner. They weren't just trying, Ian Williams, Ray McDonald, Ahmad Brooks. They weren't just trying to hit you. They were trying to inflict pain. They were as physical and as savage of a defense as has been played in the last 20 years. They might not be the best, but just physicality, there you could put them on par with anybody. And he stood in there like a champion over and over and over again at Candlestick and found a way to win that game. Eli Manning. Then he went to the Super Bowl and beat Belichick and Brady again. Which, I mean, there's no other way around it. That was a huge revenge game for them and made two of the most... Definitely made one of the most historical plays in Super Bowl history, the catch to Tyree. Like, that happened. So in a day and age where we love to talk about regular season games, which, you know, let's call it what it is, don't mean that much anymore. And I love it when people, like, try to temper down, like, we're just in a ring culture. Yeah, because that's the most important thing. Winning playoff games and winning rings. Winning important games. Like, yeah, winning early games in early October are cool. But that's not the point of this whole deal. It's trying to win championships. It's why the people that we admire most in sports, and just historically in sports, whether it's George Steinbrenner, whether it's the Lakers, whether it's Belichick, whether it's Walsh, winners. Tiger Woods, winners. And Eli Manning has two seasons that you can put up par with anybody in terms of a stretch in the playoffs. So to me, you can't tell the story of the NFL without putting him in the Hall of Fame. Now, I'm not saying he's a perfect Hall of Famer, because by no means he is. But when guys like Jason Taylor are getting in, and Tim Brown are getting in, just stat stuffers, and this guy has two rings that in those 2 years, he threw 15 touchdowns and two picks, and had a completion percentage, I think it was like a little over 63%. Like, that's what the $252 million was basically for those eight games, those eight playoff games. And two of them were Super Bowls. That's... if you ask John Mara, the $252 million, if you had to put it in a pie chart where the majority of it were worth, he'd be like, well, about $50 million was just Eli carrying himself with class and representing our organization. But probably about $200 million worth for those eight games. Every stinking penny was worth it. Every stinking one. So I got no problem with Eli one day going to the Hall of Fame because at the end of the day, the whole point of everything, especially what I'm talking about, is trying to win a ring. And I think that gets lost in just the culture of today and just, you know, participation trophies, and Kobe's dealing with it with his little girls basketball team. But I tip my hat for those eight games for Eli Manning because they're as good as that's ever been played. Okay, let's go game by game. There's a couple good college games on Saturday. Oklahoma State at Texas. Notre Dame at Georgia, even though I think Georgia's going to kick their ass. And, yeah, that's about it. But it's kind of a weak college kind of lineup. And there is, I'm actually pretty excited for USC taking on Utah. So if you're listening to this on Friday, they're playing tonight. If you're listening to this over the weekend, the game already happened. But I think Utah kicks their ass too. But let's dive into the NFL games like I always do. I just wrote down every game, and I'll just try to spend like less than a minute. Just the first thing that comes to my mind. Denver at Green Bay. I mean, Green Bay's defense this year has been unreal. Denver, you know, should have won the game if Elway's just blasting Garrett Bowles. Like, John, you drafted the guy. So, yeah, he holds a lot. That's on you. I have a hard time. The line's 7.5. I don't know if Green Bay's blowing it at anyone because their offense has kind of been hit or miss. But I have a hard time seeing Joe Flacco going on the road against a top five defense and getting a win. I don't see it happening. So I like Green Bay to win this game and start 3-0. Lions at Philly, line 6. The Eagles they weren't able to practice on Wednesday. They have so many damn injuries. Carson Wentz can only do so much. Lions are one of those weird teams. They do have some talent, but, I mean, no one trusts the coach. I would say this is a winnable game, but is Matt Patricia and the Lions, I don't care how injured the Eagles are, going into the link and getting a win. I can't see it. So while I don't like the Eagles in the 6 points just because of how many injuries they're dealing with, I think the Eagles win this game. To me, easily the game of the week from just kind of a cool, interesting standpoint, Ravens-Chiefs. Mahomes versus Lamar, Andy versus Harbaugh. I just simply can't wait for this. I simply can't wait. We know Mahomes is a star, but I think Lamar, and I know the Chiefs defense is not the 85 Bears, but if he goes on the road to Kansas City's home opener and, you know, throws for 3 or 4 touchdowns, I think we're going to have to just, you know, I've been hesitant to do it. Just call the guy a superstar. Atlanta at Indy. This is an interesting game because, like I said, I didn't take Atlanta seriously after week one. Even last week, it took a 4th-and-4 quick screen to Julio to win them the game. I think Indy is kind of shown. They're not the best team in the league now with Luck on, but they might be the most mentally tough team. You can't break them. They're really tough to beat. I love everything that Indy stands for. I love Chris Ballard. I just like the culture that they've implemented in that organization, the opposite of the loosey-goosey, terrible culture that Ryan Grigson had implemented. Ballard's gone the other way. Indy's given up 1.5. Atlanta's the wide receivers are stars. I mean, Julio, Ridley, Sanu. But I just like Indy in this game. But this is a tough game. I wouldn't bet this game, but it's a fun game to watch. Raiders at Minnesota. Gruden's in year two, and already week three, he's a 9-point underdog. I like Minnesota to kick the crap out of the Raiders. Good stat today by one of the local guys here in the Bay. The Raiders, on their first drive of the game, averaged like, you know, 2 points a possession, and that was like 5th in the NFL over the last 2 years. After that, they averaged like 27th in the league. So it's pretty much Gruden's a great first 15 coach, but after that, the offense sputters. I don't see any chance on God's green earth the Raiders go into Minnesota and win, let alone even stay close. I think Minnesota destroys them. Then we got two games, which might be a record for week three. The Jets and the Miami Dolphins, both in obviously the AFC East, are a combined 55-point underdog. 55-point underdog. I don't even know what to say. The Jets at New England, I'm not going to watch one snap of that game. Miami at Dallas, I'll probably watch negative snaps of that game. I would say New England, I have zero reservation that they're going to take the Jets seriously because they take every opponent seriously. So they're going to try. My one thing with Dallas is, are you telling me that Amari Cooper and Ezekiel Elliott and some of the younger guys on Dallas' defense are taking that offense seriously? Like, I know Dak will, but I could see, like, Zeke not having the best week of practice. And that's not a criticism. If you put me in Zeke's body, I wouldn't be able to take the Dolphins seriously. This is a tough week for Jason Garrett to keep his guys focused against a team that's actively tanking, that's been an embarrassment so far on tape. At least, like, the Jets try. You know, the Jets just aren't any good because their quarterback made out with a chick and has mono, and they're playing with Luke Falk. Le'Veon Bell's running hard. Jamal Adams playing hard. Like, the Jets try. They just have way too many injuries. They just stink right now. The Dolphins, too, double whammy. They don't try, and they've traded all their players. So, again, these two teams, the Jets and the Dolphins, on the road are a combined 55-point underdog. That is insane. Giants at Tampa. Interested to watch Daniel Jones in his first start. The one thing I said during the preseason is Daniel Jones is playing like guys that are selling insurance right now. So, to try to translate his preseason play to this game, I think is really tough. Especially against Todd Bowles, who's one of the better defensive coordinators in the league, who brings constant pressure. It's not like the Bucs have the 2001 defensive roster, but they will fly around. I think that Daniel Jones gets humbled a little bit in this game, and I like Tampa to kick their ass. Here's the other thing with Tampa. You got Atlanta, which I think is a pretty, not a fraud, but I just don't think they're that good. You have the Saints that might be screwed, right? They lost Drew Brees for potentially 6 weeks, might be more. And then you have the Cam Newton-less Carolina Panthers that are also screwed. I don't think it's insane. Now, I would say it's still unlikely, but Tampa could be a sleeper divisional champ, you know, at like 8-8, 9-7. Because they do have some players. If they can just keep Jameis on the straight and narrow, the coaching staff's really good. I'm just telling you, just keep an eye on Tampa Bay. Panthers at Arizona. You know, Kyle Allen, this game interests me very little. I probably won't watch much of this game. Saints at Seattle's interesting for a couple reasons. One, Seattle wins this game, they're 3-0, and you're like, God, are they a lock playoff team? Because that's how they're kind of feeling. Sean Payton has kind of refused to name a starter. Now, they're paying Teddy Bridgewater, what, like $7.5 million to be the backup, so it would be a pretty alarming if Teddy Bridgewater didn't start this game. But this Taysom Hill character is a pretty interesting guy. I think that both those two guys are going to play a lot in this game. This is kind of a big muscle flex game for Sean Payton. Like, can he function without Drew Brees? He's never really had to. If he could go on the road with some combination of Teddy and Taysom Hill and beat Seattle at home, that would be really, really impressive. Now, I like Seattle in this game. I think you're not going to Seattle with your backup quarterback and winning. I doubt that's happened in the Pete Carroll era. But if anyone could do it, it'd be a guy like Sean Payton. Houston almost at the Clippers. Whenever I see LAC, I think the Clippers. I just don't think Houston's that good. I mean, they have a couple, I've changed my opinion on them the last couple weeks. They obviously have a couple elite players. Deshaun special, DeAndre Hopkins, a baller. JJ Watt kind of looks like a shell of himself. Listen, I get that Bill O'Brien didn't like Clowney in the weight room and he didn't lift hard enough and maybe didn't practice hard enough. But you know what Jadeveon Clowney did the last 2 years for the Texans on Sundays? He wrecked shop. He dominated. They're missing him right now. And at the end of the day, Laremy Tunsil is a really good player. But you can only impact the game so much as one individual offensive lineman. Because really, the offensive line is played as a unit. Like, you can impact the game a lot as a defensive lineman. While the defensive line is played as a unit, if you're an outside pass rusher, you have a lot of control over what's going on. If you're the left tackle, like, you can't help that the right guard sucks or the center's getting smoked or your right tackle can't move. But if you're just Clowney, you could get 2 sacks in a game or just dominate. They can't run to a certain place. You can change the game, and that's what Clowney did. Now, the Chargers, again, I almost said the Clippers, have a ton of injuries. This is a big game. It really is. Both these two teams are 1-1. Whoever wins this game is going to be feeling pretty good, especially I don't know about the Chargers. I would have said when we were going into training camp, the Chargers were a lock playoff team. Then Derwin James goes down, their left tackle's nowhere to be found. Hunter Henry's now out. I'm not feeling too good about either one of these teams. I'm really not. I'm pretty fascinated by this game. I wouldn't bet it. The Chargers are, you know, just home favored by 3 points, but I don't feel very good about it at all. Okay, let's get into the old Middlecoff mailbag. And we do that on Instagram, at John Middlecoff. You get up in those DMs, and I answer your questions here. So let's fire away. Steelers fan, been listening to the podcast almost a year now and figured I'd send a DM. I was wondering your thoughts are on Mason Rudolph. I thought he was a steal in the third round, and I like what I've seen so far against the Seahawks and in the preseason, but it's still a small sample size. So I guess the question is, what do I think? I would say, well, I didn't really watch Steelers preseason, so and I think we've seen over the years you can't put any stock into there. But I'm with you. I went back and watched, getting ready for the Niner game. He was pretty good in the second half. He's cool, calm, collected. He's a big guy. He obviously, I think, has small hands. So that's going to be a concern as they get into colder weather games. But this is a pretty big first test. You go on the road in a game against a defense that's pretty good. Their pass rush is really good. Watching the Steelers, one thing that jumps out is a couple years ago, they were an elite offensive team. They had Ben. They had Antonio Brown. They had Le'Veon Bell. They were just elite. And now I'm watching them. Like, I like Juju, but they got Johnny Holton. They got Vance McDonald. You know, they got James Conner. The weapons aren't quite the same, and clearly the defense isn't that good. So it's not going to be easy. He's not walking into Mike Wallace, you know, Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell. That's not the case here. So I don't really have an opinion on him. Besides, I'm with you. I like what I saw in Seattle, but I don't know what really to make of it. He was at home, but it was off the bench. Anytime you come in off the pine mid-game and look, you know, serviceable, that's impressive. I know people were sending me tweets and DMs that the Steelers said when they drafted him that they had a first-round grade on him. So they valued him. Now, they passed on him twice, but obviously Ben a couple years ago was younger. I'd say the one concerning part would be last year he couldn't beat out Joshua Dobbs, which, you know, coming from Oklahoma State, maybe the transition was harder than they thought. They clearly liked him a lot more than Joshua Dobbs this year, having traded him to be Minshew's backup now. So I would say that I am optimistically excited to watch him play. My expectations, though, aren't very high. I would say they're 0-2 right now. If he goes 7-7 the rest of the season and they go 7-9, that will be pretty impressive. That will be pretty impressive. What's up, John? Huge fan of 3 and Out, and you've inspired me to get into this podcasting business, albeit on an amateur level. You're a huge role model for me. I appreciate that. I don't know if I've ever been called a role model. Thank you. How do you think the Eagles measure up to the rest of the NFC, and do you trust Doug and Carson to elevate their individual talents to ultimately weather the Jackson and Alshon storm? I would say they measure up when healthy as good as anybody. They are, I'd put them right up there. You have New England and Kansas City, cream of the crop in the AFC, and then to me the NFC is the Eagles, when healthy, the Eagles, the Cowboys, Saints, see ya, maybe the Rams, and then who knows in the NFC North. I'd say it's just to me the Eagles and the Cowboys are the two best teams, when healthy. Right now the Cowboys are a little more healthy, but they're kind of banged up too. But the Eagles were in shambles. I mean, they're starting two wide receivers, second tight end that's a really good player, didn't get to play. Their one kryptonite is a little bit, you know, the corners. I would say this, though. Like you said, can those guys elevate? That's why Howie drafts players like the running back from Penn State, J.J. Arcega-Whiteside. It's why they still kept Nelson Aguilar on the squad. It's why they have Zach Ertz. It's why they keep, you know, Jason Peters and draft Andre Dillard. Like, they are equipped. They have a lot of bodies they can keep throwing out. Doug's proven to be one of the best play callers in the league. And like I said, under the older guys, over 30, you know, the Russell Wilson and older guys, there's no one with the high end of Wentz beside Mahomes. So you're looking at, like, LeBron and Kevin Durant. Like, that's how I'd put it. You know, if I think Mahomes could kind of be the LeBron, but Wentz would be like Durant. So Wentz can be that good. And I think you saw in Atlanta, they went into a hostile environment with kind of some crazy circumstances right before the game, and they probably should have won the game. You know, if they just can somehow tackle Julio on a 4th-and-4. I mean, you got to give Atlanta credit. They called the perfect play. But they were in position to win. That's all you can ask for, given those circumstances. Now, the injuries are a problem. Like, how long are these guys out? And here's the thing. Like, Deshaun's 32 years old, so he might miss time. You know, is Alshon going to miss a week, or is he going to miss like a month? Are those two guys going to miss a combined 2 games, or are they going to miss 7 combined, right? So I think that's where it gets interesting. They still got a good defensive coordinator. They got a really good defensive line that they could get to 9-10 wins, worst case scenario, no matter what. So I trust Doug and Carson for sure. Beside Kellen Moore, what OC quarterback coaches are at the top of their games, future head coaches? I was thinking about that. Beside Kellen Moore, I don't know if there really are the quote-unquote future head coaches right now in the league. I know Eric Bieniemy with Andy in Kansas City is going to definitely get some love. If somehow the Tampa Bay Bucks, you know, win 8-9 games, I think Byron Leftwich will get some love under Bruce Arians. You know, if Kyle Shanahan this year is able to make the playoffs, he's got a bunch of minions, little right-hand guys that would get some pub for sure. Maybe, you know, I mean, shit, you work for Sean McVay. Jed Fish with Sean McVay may get a shot. But I don't think it's as clear as it was like 3 or 4 years ago when it was like Kyle, Nagy, McVay. There was kind of a group of them right before, like when Adam Gase was coming up. Like it was clear. There's not really that guy. And don't forget this. Kellen Moore's 31 years old. I just don't think, even if the Cowboys, let's say, won the Super Bowl this year, even though by the time they were on a Super Bowl run, he'd be getting interviewed. I don't know. You know, he's 31 years old. He comes from a coaching background. I don't think he's just, this isn't some money grab. To me, there's what separates people in life. I say this all the time about me, and I think you see this a lot of people that get into pro sports, whether it's through media or wanted. Like, I never got into this for the money. This was my only option, too. Like, this wasn't a side hobby. This is my life. So it's easy. When it's your life, it's easier to make big picture thoughts and big picture decisions, or have big picture thoughts to enable you to make big picture decisions. Like, Kellen Moore already has some money. He played in the league for a couple years, so that means at minimum he's been making $500,000-$600,000. He's now the OC, and he was a quarterback coach. He's made some cash. I don't think he's just in this huge rush to be a head coach. I could be wrong. Like, when Matt Nagy became the head coach of the Chicago Bears, he'd been working under Andy Reid for 8 years. You know, maybe 9. You know, Doug Peterson had been in the NFL and been an assistant coach for a while. Like, Adam Gase had been an offensive coordinator multiple spots. And they were pretty young. Like, Sean McVay was a little bit of an outlier. But Sean McVay, when he got done playing at Ohio, immediately went into coaching. So he got his job at, what, 31 years old? He was in the league apprenticing under Gruden, Shanahan, and Gruden, the other Gruden, for a long time. You know? I mean, 10-plus years, not that long, but long enough. Really, Kellen Moore's been coaching. This is his second year. Now, he's been doing it and thinking about it his entire life. But I bet he'd tell you, like, I still want some more reps. And I got news for you. He's got a pretty good gig. You ever heard of that Jerry Jones guy? You can pay him a lot of money. So maybe Kellen interviews somewhere just to get a little bump and a raise. And maybe they pay him $2 or $3 million a year. But I would be, my take right now as of September 19th at 9:16 at night, I'd be shocked if Kellen Moore is a head coach next year. Not because he won't have options, but because I don't know. I just don't see it. With P.I. being reviewable, do you see teams having the backup come in and chuck Hail Marys on third and longs? It happened with Seattle against the Steelers on a weak call, but the letter of the law, the refs have to call it. The one thing I would say is that I've seen some people throw flags on P.I. plays. The point of the rule is for egregious P.I. plays, not ticky-tack stuff. Like Gruden last week threw one on a ticky-tack play, and they're not overturning ticky-tack stuff. And a couple people like tweeted at me, it's black and white. You either did PI or PI. That's not what the rule is for. They even said when they changed it, it was for the Rams-Saints type play. Egregious errors. This is football. You're allowed to hand fight a little bit. You're allowed to be there a little early. You know, I have no problem. I like to give the defensive player a little room for error. A defensive holding is my least favorite penalty in all of football. Because it's like, what the hell is a defensive guy supposed to do? Now, if it's blatant defensive holding, I get it. But just the occasional kind of touching you and grabbing your jersey, like, what are they supposed to do? Do you see Jerry ponying up to keep Kellen as an OC until it's time to move on from Garrett, or do you see him trying to scoop him up next season? So it's kind of a Kellen Moore. The one caveat could be, and I don't see this happening just because I think Jerry loves Jason Garrett, would Jerry Jones make Kellen Moore the head coach and just let Jason Garrett walk? My gut would be if they, you know, if they win the East and they win a couple playoff games, or just hell, they lost in the NFC Championship game, Garrett would get an extension, and Kellen Moore would just get a raise. Now there is a chance. I just think Jerry's too old to do something kind of crazy, and he knows like there's a floor, like his teams are going to be solid with Jason. Now, he could take a swing for a fence, but he's 76, 77 years old. If it went poorly, it could cost him a lot if Kellen's just not ready. And it's I always defend Jason. Like, to me, there's stuff that Kellen can learn from Jason, just how to run an operation, how to stay cool, just all that stuff. That's why I think actually it's a good guy for him to apprentice under, because X's and O's wise, like, Kellen's going to be on top of that. He's special. But some of the other stuff, you can always just be around a guy. Like, Jason's a good program guy. I don't know if he's a great individual X's and O's guy, which is kind of ironic because he was an Ivy League quarterback. But sometimes it's just not his strength. Been supporting you since the beginning. Appreciate that. 49ers are looking good despite Gucci Garoppolo needing to knock off the rust. If he can stay healthy and continue to build himself back into previous form, are the 49ers actually a potential wild horse dark horse? Hard to believe I'm asking this, but the Seahawks, assuming they don't land Ramsey, look vulnerable, and right now the 49ers look better overall. Just got me a little shook. Hometown bias aside, your thoughts? I actually think Seattle looks solid. They're not like just some team that's going to dominate anyone, but like I said last week, their record since 2012 is 77 and 36. All they do is win. Like, it's not going to look pretty, and at the end of the year, they're going to have 10 wins. I think the question is how many games are the Rams going to win? I think they'll beat the Browns this week, but something's off about them because Gurley's not the same. Now, McVay's a stud, Goff's still solid, and they can pass the ball, but their secondary's not great. Aaron Donald at any moment can just take over a game. Could all three teams come from the NFC West? I would say a little unlikely because the Eagles and the Cowboys. But at the end of the day, I think the division's going to come down to this. If any of those three teams slip up to Arizona, which all three of them should sweep, and then what do they do against each other? Does any of the three teams go 4-0? You know, does like the Rams sweep the Niners, sweep Seattle, or vice versa, right? Or does one team go 3-1 and the others go 2-2? That could be a swing game. And that, I just don't know. Like, I can't anoint and feel good about the Niners being a wild card, like making the wild card. But if they win this weekend, I feel pretty confident they're in the wild card mix. And to me, the wild card mix is probably 10 games. You know, 9 ain't getting you in. If Dallas, Philly, Seattle, LA, Niners, you know, Chicago, Green Bay, Minnesota, 9 might win the division in the South, but these other teams, I think to get the 5th and 6th wild card spot, you're probably going to have to win 10, 11 games. I'm from Seattle and a Homer's Hawk fan. Does it seem like, once again, everyone isn't talking about Seattle? Here's what's funny. Or just giving them credit since the Niners and Rams are doing good and are in the same division? I feel like every year Russell gets shaded now with Mahomes and Lamar killing it. Yeah, I mean, I think he's a star, man. I think he's an absolute star. So, I don't shade Seattle at all. To me, they're one of the standards in the league. Obviously, the Patriots are the standard, and then there's just next tier. And I'd put right now the next tier kind of has two teams, maybe three teams, that are kind of establishing themselves. Now, this Howie Doug run, Andy Veach and KC and Seattle. And I think McVay's throwing their hat in the ring if they make the playoffs again this year. You know, even the Saints, we'll see. Like, they lost Breeze. Can they withstand it? Can the Steelers lose Ben and withstand it? It's hard. You know, it's hard to just be concerned. Look at the Packers. They haven't made the playoffs in a couple years. A couple things have gone wrong. It's hard to kind of battle through the adversity. So it's just really difficult to just maintain winning. And I'd say the two most consistent teams these last 5 or 6 years, beside the Patriots, obviously, have been Seattle and Kansas City. What's up, John? Do you think college football expanded the playoffs so the teams would be more inclined to play a tougher schedule? One loss wouldn't be a season killer. It seems like a fair amount of games are wasted playing terrible, unranked teams. Who wants to watch 55-0 blowouts? I would agree to that. I think that's a huge... It's kind of an epidemic right now. Like, an epidemic in the NBA is guys sitting. The epidemic in college football are teams refusing to play anyone in non-conference, especially the SEC teams. I mean, I think there's an easy fix. That you maintain, the NCAA passes a rule, if you play 12 games and 9 of them are conference and you get 3 non-conference games or 8 of your conference, whatever, mandatory you play 2 Power 5 teams non-conference. Mandatory. Then the third you can play Cal Poly, you know, some teams still might play like a Nevada or something, but it's mandatory you play two Power 5 teams. I think that would help solve it. So basically the month of September is Alabama playing Washington, is Iowa playing USC, you know, is Clemson playing Penn State, it's Georgia, I mean, I give Georgia credit, they do it, Notre Dame, it's, you know, BYU playing Utah. You get those type games, and I think we all want it. That's what we want to see, and who knows? I doubt it happens, though. Should the Bears orchestrate a trade with the Dolphins to get Josh Rosen? Trubisky has looked like hot garbage and not long-term solution and is holding back a top-10 roster. Top-10? I mean, I think it's top-5 roster in the league. Or am I blind as a Bears fan and the Packers plus the Broncos have elite defenses that look okay enough to considering he was too good to play preseason football? Well, we get to see him on Monday Night Football. And I think this week's pretty black and white. Trubisky's got to play better. He's on Monday Night Football against the Washington Redskins. Like, it's time to play better. Like, top-10 roster. The Bears have a top-5 roster. If you put Kel Gardner-Minshew on that team right now, I think they'd win 12 games. Now, they won 12 last year, but Mitch isn't playing as well as he did last year. He's just got to step it up. And I think we'll know here pretty soon. Seahawks fan here. What are your expectations? Kind of just talked about that. Plus, why does Russell Wilson get lost in the great quarterback discussion? It's a hell of a question, man. I think sometimes you just do it over and over and over again, and your Super Bowl was 5 or 6 years ago now. People just don't talk about you as much. Plus, I got news for you. When you're on the West Coast, you don't drive conversation. I mean, that's what makes Colin unique, is he's the biggest national brand by far. But most national brands ride the East Coast. They ride for those, you know, the Eagles, the Giants. Hell, they talk about the shitty Jets before they talk about the good Niners. It's just the way it is. You know, only in basketball if the Warriors are that good. Like, even when the Giants were winning World Series out here in the San Francisco, people are still talking Yankees, Red Sox, Cubs. There's a real thing for East Coast bias, and part of it is just a numbers game. I think 65% of the population lives, is it west of Chicago or something? It's just nature of the way guys are wired, and most of the bosses, the northeast intellectual elites in the media companies are from New York or Boston or Philly or Washington. They don't give a shit about us, which is fine because I don't really care that much about them, though I do enjoy watching and talking about them. But I ride for the West Coast, and I'll tell you this. I'll go to the mat for Russell Wilson. He's one of the best players I've ever seen in any sport. And there's no one that I would want to, if my days of being a fan are long over. I mean, I grew up a Niner fan, but when I worked in the league and even now, like, I just don't care as much. Now, the Niners are good for my business on my other podcast, Haverman Middlecoff. The better they do, the better my business is, more people listen. So, I mean, I want them to do well, but I don't live and die with the games anymore unless I bet it, you know, or unless, like, I get more juiced up when I see Matt Nagy win or when I see Andy and Veach crushing it. You know, that's what I get joy out of. Hell, Sean McDermott, I don't even talk to anymore, but I root for that guy. Guys that I've known, you know, guys that I just like. Hell, I like Vic Fangio. I want to see Vic Fangio do well. I really just more root for people. But, you know, if I'm a Niner fan and I can put that hat back on, Russell Wilson would be one of the last guys I want to see. If Tom Brady's one, hell, Mahomes might be one too. Russell Wilson would be top two or three. I mean, he scares the bejeebus out of me. Have you ever thought about doing a live podcast breakdown a game? Joe Rogan does a similar thing with the fight companions for UFC events, and they are hugely popular. He gets some friends together, has a few beers, and provides different take on the usual commentary. I haven't. Sounds a little interesting. I don't know exactly how I do it. Sometimes I go live at halftime, like on Periscope for Twitter. But yeah, I mean, I'd definitely be open to that. You grab some beers, you know, just blast some people while the game's going on. I'll be honest. Sometimes I just like watching the game. I mean, I do like watching the game and then reacting like here, but I'm not opposed to that. And that's clearly something Barstool does, some stuff like that. Sometimes I watch stuff like that and I kind of just wears me out. Now again, I despise the majority of announcing crews. So I think when you look at the way the business is going, stuff like that is where we're headed. But I think it has to be done right. And, but yeah, I'm not, It definitely crossed my mind at many different times, how can I set up and do something like that? But I'll be honest, and I'm sure Rogan's kind of like this, I would never aspire to be an analyst. Like, mine would be pretty low-key, just probably talking a lot of shit and just blasting and just having a good time. So if that's what you're talking about, then yeah, I think about it a lot. Let's see if I can find any more DMs here. Do you think the Colts are a legitimate contender? Brissett looks good. The O-line is one of the best in the league, and their D is solid. Yeah, I mean, I think the way I would describe that division, if they keep Jalen Ramsey, the Jags are interesting. Gardner Minshew's no joke. The Titans, Mariota's just not good enough. The Texans are an extremely flawed yet talented team. And I think the Colts have the most heart, desire, and just natural coaching. And they have the organizational kind of metal. I mean, their GM's the real deal. The guys they've brought in are the real deal. I was DMing with someone, the guy that just DM'd me a question about the Colts. And we just go back and forth. I mean, sometimes you DM me at the right time and I'm on it. We'll just start talking. And I was telling him, like, the thing that's most impressive about Chris Ballard, Bill Polian's a Hall of Famer. He was like a home run hitter. And when he hit a home run, it'd be like Joe Carter, walk off World Series, you know? It was incredible. I mean, from Peyton Manning and then to all the other guys, the Reggie Waynes, Harrisons, Harrison might have already been there, but Dallas Clarks to Dwight Freeney to Robert Mathis. But they were an extremely flawed team. They had holes everywhere. Remember, Peyton Manning's offensive lines weren't that great. Their defenses, beside the two pass rushers, if Bob Sanders was hurt, was always holes everywhere. Chris Ballard's team's kind of the opposite. His star player is one he inherited, T.Y. Hilton. Most of the guys he has are just solid. Now, you could argue Quentin Nelson's a star, but for the most part, if Andrew Luck in like 2003 would have been Bill Polian's quarterback and just retired, Bill Polian's team would have won 3 games. Andrew Luck retired, and Chris Ballard's team is prepared to win 9 or 10 games. To me, I think that's a positive indictment. Is that an oxymoron? It just shows how impressive Ballard has been on building this team and how good Frank Wright and his staff. I can never say, I always say Frank Wright, like R-I-G-H-T, but it's Frank Reich, and how good his staff and Eberflus, remember, who was hired by Josh McDaniels, has really been. But I think the guy at the top of the pyramid, Ballard, the type players, if you had to describe Chris Ballard as a baseball player, I would describe him as Tony Gwynn. He's up there just hitting singles and doubles. He ain't going to hit a home run, but he's going to hit 380, and he's headed probably to the Hall of Fame because he's just always going to be on base. And that's what Chris Ballard's drafting strategy is. And I used to be more, my philosophical belief in drafting was a little more like Polian. Take swings. Like big swings. I think I'd go the opposite. I would try to become Ballard. And it's hard. I mean, I was raised around Coach Reed. Now, I like the flash, man. I love the Mahomes. I love the Deshauns. I love the Sammy Watkins and the Tyreek Hills and the Shadys. Like, I like that. But the Ballard way, unless you get the Mahomes, is a little safer. You know, he's just taking guys with really high floors. And the majority of guys he picks, and remember, the last couple years they've been winning, so he's been picking at the end of the round, or at least the last year he won. When you pick at the end of the round, if you take some flyers and take some swings and you miss, it's a disaster. But he's just taking guys like, worst case scenario, he'll just be a solid starter. So all of a sudden he has a draft and he hits on like 6 of his 9 picks and they're just starters or rotational guys. He's in pretty good shape. Then you look at like 2 straight drafts, you're like, God, he acquired 15 NFL players. Where most, even a good drafter, after 2 drafts, like, I got 4 starters and 2 Pro Bowlers. He's like, well, I got 15 players. And that's where I think he's really separated himself, is just the amount of guys he's able to kind of acquire. Because he just doesn't miss that often. But he's also, like, T.Y. Hilton, the flashiest guy, is someone that, you know, he probably would not draft. And the one thing I'll give him credit, like, he took Eric Ebron, that everyone's like, bust, and then he just rehabs and changes his career. Now, Ballard didn't do that, but to me, the organization and the philosophy and the way they think about it did. So when you have a bunch of solid guys, you can take some flyers on like other busts, like an Ebron type, and then you're going to hit on them. And he was smart a couple years ago when he traded for Jacoby because they have a functional quarterback on a really solid team. That's what, if you take a step back and you went, Andrew Luck had been healthy and he had been on this Colts team, I think we'd be saying there are three teams in the AFC. If Andrew Luck was healthy and playing right now, you'd go the Patriots, cream of the crop, defending champs. They get the one slot. The Chiefs are really good, and they'd be the two. But you'd be like, I think Indy. I know Bills handled Indy over the years, and Andy kicked their ass last year. But you're like, well, if they just you can't just discount them. Now, they would still be the clear three, but they would be the three. Right now, there is no three in the AFC. Maybe it's Baltimore. We'll find out after this weekend. But, yeah, I think it's a long-winded way of saying I think the Colts could easily make the playoffs, yes, because I think they could win the division. I think the division might be won by 9-7. I'm not that big on the Houston Texans right now. Appreciate everyone listening. Have a good weekend. And enjoy the football. And tell all your friends about the 3 and Out podcast, because I want more people to listen. I appreciate everyone. Godspeed. See ya. Safe travels. Just enjoy the weekend. Adios.